Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, WWNO's weekly look at the New Orleans literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with biographer Nigel Hamilton, author of Commander-in-Chief, FDR's Battle with Churchill, 1943. And I'll review Beach Books, set in Russia for escape reading. Best-selling, award-winning biographer Nigel Hamilton divides his time between Boston and New Orleans, and he is a senior fellow at the McCormick Graduate School at the University of Massachusetts. He's written books about President John F. Kennedy, General Bernard Monty Montgomery, and President Bill Clinton. Currently, he's working on a multi-volume project about Franklin Delano Roosevelt. When last we spoke, it was about the mantle of command, FDR at War, 1941 to 1942, and now he's continued that work in Commander-in-Chief, FDR's Battle with Churchill, 1943. Nigel Hamilton, I'm so happy to welcome you back.
Oh, not at all. I'm delighted to be here.
Now, these two men, Roosevelt and Churchill, had such a complicated relationship. And you seem to think, you come down very firmly on the side that Churchill has gotten the lion's share of the credit. And you're correcting our impressions of Roosevelt for the future.
Well, I'd certainly like to change history. I think it was always said of Winston Churchill that he won the war twice, first as Prime Minister of England, and then writing his account of the war in six very heavy volumes, which won the Nobel Prize for Literature. And he was such a wonderful writer, absolutely magisterial writer, that his version of how he won World War II in terms of strategy has really gone down in history as the sort of received opinion. And although I have tremendous admiration for Winston Churchill as the leader of his country, especially in 1940 when Britain was really pretty much alone against Hitler, his role as Commander-in-Chief is something very different. And I'm looking at FDR in terms of his role as Commander-in-Chief of the Armed Forces of the United States, not as a diplomat, not in terms of the New Deal, not as an economist, just how did he direct the military of the United States in the most violent war in human history? How did he do it? How did he work with his generals? To what extent did he direct the strategy rather than Winston Churchill? And it's really incredible that nobody has ever done this before. Mm-hmm. Churchill, in that sense, got away with murder. So the problem was that FDR died in 1945, just before the war ended in April of 1945. And so he had begun to assemble his papers. I interviewed his last senior officer in the map room at the White House, now the kind of Situation Room, but this map room that FDR had set up. And he had begun to help the president put together his papers, but he died in 1945. And so his story has gone untold. And I think that's very unfair and unjust, because I really think he was, in the end, the single most important figure in World War II, certainly on the side of the Western Allies. And if it had not been for FDR in 1943, it is very possible that we could have lost World War II, certainly in Europe.
And you seem to be very drawn to him personally in terms of the way he thought, the way he was with people. I remember one particular little thing you said, well, he was going to set someone straight and he would do it nicely. And it was just, you know, you take a lot of care in your characterization of him.
Well, he is, as you said earlier, I mean, these are two extraordinary men. And I certainly wouldn't belittle Winston Churchill. Had an incredible, he was a genius, I mean, an extraordinary mind. But he is such a different character from President Roosevelt. Whereas Churchill sort of likes action this day, and he's bossy and wants everything done in 2 seconds. So the president actually listens to people. He likes to make his decisions after hearing the different sides. He doesn't like to offend people while he's collecting that material that he needs. A man of extraordinary judgment. And that's a quality which I think we should look for in our leaders. And I think to the extent that he was able to override his own generals, these professionals, FDR never having been to military college, he had been assistant Navy secretary in the First World War, but he'd never worn uniform, that he should have been able, particularly in this period covered by this book, not only to override his generals in terms of general strategy, but to do it for such a wonderful reason. Namely, he wanted to make sure that American boys actually had a chance of learning on the battlefield how to defeat the Germans, the Wehrmacht. Mm-hmm. And it is extraordinary. At the beginning of the book, he goes out. He's the first president ever to fly, first president to visit a foreign battlefield during war. He flies to Casablanca. Ironically, he's seen the film just before he goes out but with Ingrid Bergman. But that was purely coincidence. Mm-hmm. He'd already arranged to go out there. And when he goes out there, you know, the first thing he does, he wants to meet the battlefield commanders, General Patton, General Clark, General Eisenhower. He wants to talk to them. You know, he wants to eat out of, you know, ordinary aluminum cups,
right,
and learn what his men are going to have to face, what they are going to have to learn before they could ever consider tackling anything as ambitious as D-Day. And so we owe such a debt of gratitude to him that he overruled his chiefs of staff and said, no, we won't launch D-Day in 1943. We will wait until we've learned on the battlefield how to defeat the Nazis and the Wehrmacht. And when we're ready, then we will build up our forces in Britain and we will launch this cross-channel invasion, the D-Day invasion, in the spring of the following year.
And he undertook all these travels at great personal effort. I mean, this was a struggle for him. These were not easy things for him to do.
Right. I mean, he's a paraplegic. He's in a wheelchair, has been since 1921. It is really extraordinary. And most people didn't even realize.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, just to get into an aeroplane, they had to build a special ramp for him, get it into a boat. And it is an absolutely extraordinary story of human courage. And he never liked to talk about it. He'd much prefer you didn't. He didn't want anybody's pity, in other words. Yes.
Now, I'd like to ask you a bit about your approach. In your last book, Mantle of Command, you took 14 significant episodes and wrote the book around those. And this is 12 episodes over a year. Is that how you approach big projects like this? Is that how you break them down, survey the sweep of history, lift these things up and build stories around them?
Faute de mieux, yes. Because Churchill had 6 volumes.
Mm-hmm.
My British publisher fired me when I said I wanted to do 2, let alone 3. So, in other words, it's a matter of how much space you're going to be allowed by your publisher. And I felt this is such an important story that even if I lose my British publisher, to hell with them. For an American audience, I want to tell this extraordinary American story. But I can't tell everything.
Yeah.
You have to be selective. And I thought the best way to do it as a biographer as well as a historian was to choose episodes that show us exactly how this president works, sort of from the inside, up close at the White House or in this aeroplane going to Casablanca, using the diaries of people around him, the letters that he would wrote, to try and recreate those moments. And those moments have to do duty for the periods that I can't cover.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, in this particular volume, the new volume, I haven't been able to go into several really important areas like the Pacific War. There is an extraordinary moment where he authorizes a sort of drone strike of 1943, extraordinary episode where American intelligence informs him that they know that the commander-in-chief of the Japanese Navy is going to be somewhere at a certain time. Are they allowed to take him out? And the president says, yes.
And that chapter is called Get Yamamoto. I love that. It's James Bond worthy, you know.
Right.
Now, one of the things that comes through this book, some of the great themes in this book are, you know, during wartime, how difficult it is to maintain these international alliances, often unconventional alliances between different sorts of people, and how self-interest and ego come into play as well on the parts of these commanders, as well as the baselines of, you know, resources and commitment. So there's almost a kind of complicated emotional battle that you have to portray as well.
I think that's why biography is so important, mm-hmm. because historians often don't get that. They don't see it as a clash of personalities. They feel that there are patterns of history and that if only you understand the pattern, everything else is inevitable. Well, it isn't inevitable.
Yeah.
And FDR makes mistakes. I mean, he goes out to Casablanca and he's introduced to Charles de Gaulle. And de Gaulle is incredibly rude to him. And the president takes this amiss. He's insulted. He's the president of the United States. Here's this country that's been defeated by the Germans. How on earth can this man behave as and complain at the, in terms of his pride as a Frenchman that they hadn't been a sort of band, you know, playing music when he lands in North Africa and they kind of soap the windows of his car and so forth. He's all about ego. And the president rather takes against him.
Yeah.
And with real consequences for the future of France. And he doesn't at that moment, I think that was a failing, at that moment he doesn't realize that the French have been defeated and really do need a figure who can sort of regenerate their national pride. And they may not like Charles de Gaulle, and he may be an egomaniac, but that's the man the French need at that moment.
Well, so. It just cracks me up, truthfully, because when you get right down to it, Nigel, a lot of this book is about meetings. It's about setting up meetings. And you do that in a style that shows that these meetings are battles, too. They really are.
Right.
Just incredible clashes, which I sort of enjoyed immensely, especially the Casablanca chapter, of course. And the key figures in this book are well known to us, you know, if we know anything at all about the war. But so many of the staffers rise to become interesting characters in their own right as well. That must have been really fun to research, I think.
Oh, it is. And that's where, when you're looking for diaries or accounts, memoirs that people have written later, it's always so wonderful to find the lesser known characters and to be able to bring that character back to life in their relationship with the president. I mean, he has this naval aide who really doesn't want him to go to Casablanca.
Right.
So that all helps to recreate the moment in time, in history. And yes, that is again where biography can illuminate in a way that historians, unfortunately, so seldom are able to do. Or if they do it without really knowing the detail. And that's what a biographer looks for, the little detail. Rather like a novelist, but mm-hmm. I mean, we're not inventing, but that's what we're looking for, the telling detail.
Well, now we're at the point where all these departing White House staffers do memoirs, you know, with every administration. And that wasn't so much the case.
No, well, it was actually illegal to keep a diary during the war, but it was something that a lot of people paid no attention to. And I've even come across a diary that was kept by FDR. So.
Whoa, nice. Now, one of the great debates across this book is, of course, over the idea of the cross-channel invasion that would become D-Day and Churchill's resistance to that. That was fascinating to me how he dug his heels in and really did not believe in that.
Well, two things. He didn't believe it could work.
Right.
And after all, not even Hitler had to do it in the opposite direction.
Mm-hmm.
So one must grant him that. Even when it did take place, you know, it was an extraordinary operation,
yeah.
Yes, an undertaking. That's why I so admire the National World War II Museum here. But I think there was another problem with Winston Churchill, and that was that he had failed in an operation in World War I in Gallipoli, where thousands of British Empire soldiers, especially Australians, died on the beaches fighting the Turks. And it was really Churchill's fault. I mean, it was an adventure for him, but they died. But for whatever psychological reasons, he felt that the Mediterranean and the Aegean Islands around Turkey were the vital causeway into Europe in World War II, and that he would go round the back of the Germans. Well, this was pure fantasy. So a lot of the book is the trial that he put the President of the United States through. I mean, can you imagine Churchill comes across the Atlantic Ocean twice in this year? In a huge ocean liner, the Queen Mary, with 240 staffers to try and convince the President of the United States not to go ahead with D-Day. It's pretty extraordinary, of course,
it is.
And covered it all up in his six volumes.
Well, what's so interesting is that you read this book, you know it's going to happen anyway, but you still make it so suspenseful and interesting all the way through.
Well, thank you.
It's really fun to read. I do have to say I was quite taken aback by how many people saw Winston Churchill in his underwear or in his pajamas or lying in bed with a glass of scotch next to him.
Well, he was a character. And, you know, when I was a student, I stayed with Winston Churchill.
Right, I know.
At Chartwell. And he wasn't in his underwear that time, but
Darn.
He was but he was in that special suit he wore, sort of jumpsuit thing. And he was a real character. I mean, nobody, even if they disliked him, you know, like Joseph P. Kennedy hated him and mm-hmm. whatever, even if you disliked him, you accepted that this was an extraordinary man with just such a brilliant mind and such repartee, such wit, just an amazing mind.
Well, I don't want to blow it for readers, but I have to say that as a biography, this book has one of the best concluding sentences I have ever read. You get to the end of the book and you read that sentence and you go, whew, it was quite wonderful. So we'll make people wait for that. So what's next?
Well, this is the second of these books about FDR as Commander-in-Chief, and I have to do one more. And that will take us from the end of 1943, when the president goes to see Stalin for the first time on matters of great state, but also military strategy. And it goes through 1944, the D-Day invasion, the Pacific struggle between Nimitz and MacArthur as to which way we should attack Japan, and goes up to the preparations for the atomic bomb. Mm-hmm. And it will cover various things I haven't been able to cover so far, the problem of whether we could have done more to save the Jews in Europe. So there's some pretty weighty things to tackle.
Yeah.
I'm about 50 pages in, and I love New Orleans because I can not only work here, but I can also relax. And
well, we're lucky to have you whenever we do. We've been talking with Nigel Hamilton, whose new book is Commander-in-Chief, FDR's Battle with Churchill, 1943. Nigel, thank you so much.
It was a pleasure, pleasure.
This great nation will endure as it has endured. Nameless, unreasoning, unjustified terror, which paralyzes needed effort to convert retreat into advance. Let me assert my firm belief that the only thing we have to fear is fear itself.
Sometimes I like to choose summer reading as an escape to a particular place. I've spent weeks reading icy Scandinavian detective fiction, novels set in sunny Italy, or idyllic small towns in France. This week, two of the books I loved most were set in Russia, when Russia was still Russia. The allure of these two comes from both subjects and authors. The first is The Noise of Time by Julian Barnes, a brilliant depiction of the composer Dmitri Shostakovich. The other is The Summer Guest by Alison Anderson, a love song to literature and the art of translation, and the author Anton Chekhov. Anderson is the translator of one of my very favorite books, The Elegance of the Hedgehog by Muriel Barbery, and I was excited to see her imagination at work. The Noise of Time opens with a man sitting in a chair by the lift, waiting, just waiting, to be arrested by those in power. That sets the tone for much of this extremely compact and provocative novel. It is a profound meditation on art and power, on a collision course in Stalin's regime. Shostakovich lives his life in a sort of dread after Stalin denounces his most recent opera is denounced, making him an enemy of the state. As Barnes writes, writers were condemned on page one of Pravda, composers on page three, two pages apart, and yet it was not nothing. It could make the difference between death and life. In episodic fashion mimicking memory itself, Shostakovich recollects his life and loves, his wives, his children, a memorable trip to New York, his compromises, his fears, his great moments. But all this comes at a cost. As Barnes writes, he had also learned about the destruction of a human soul. While life is not a walk across a field, as the saying goes, a soul could be destroyed in one of three ways: by what others did to you, by what others made you do to yourself, and by what you voluntarily chose to do to yourself. Any single method was sufficient, though if all three were present, the outcome was irresistible. If that sounds a bit chilly, so be it. The Noise of Time is both rich in the texture of memory and moments of pointed clarity. Politics and art have rarely been combined so elegantly and beautifully in a work of fiction. The Summer Guest by Alison Anderson honors one of her favorite authors, Anton Chekhov. The story centers on a fictional diary kept by a young woman, a doctor blinded by illness, who has repaired to her family's country home. For two summers, Anton Chekhov and his family come to visit, and the two strike up a friendship. Zenaida Mikhailovna begins to keep a diary, using a complicated writing apparatus, persevering despite her lack of vision. Almost a century later, that diary resurfaces with Katya Kendall, a Russian woman who has emigrated to England and is determined to publish the book. She sends it to a translator who begins her own complicated relationship with the text. The plot twists and turns, hopes for a lost Chekhov novel, journeys to the Ukraine, and ends with a deeply satisfying twist. Much of this book is about Anton Chekhov, of course, and he emerges as a charming, considerate summer guest, if somewhat burdened by the needs of his extended family. This is not quite a vacation romance, but it is a substantial friendship. What is so lovely about The Summer Guest is the way the diary inspires Anna Hastings, the translator who takes it on. As Anderson writes, how she had struggled with the language, but learned all the while something completely unexpected and equally precious, another way of seeing the world. It was as if material things no longer had any value except as markers of memory. All the familiar concepts of wealth, ambition, power, success had seemed to fade away, irrelevant. She had been dipped into a rough poetry of everyday life, and come out not exactly speaking Russian, but versed in an idiom of pleasure and simple things, in sudden friendship, in an almost mystical perception of something deeper and inexplicably vital. An idiom of pleasure in simple things. I love that phrase. What better to seek in summer reading? And so, when Anna Hastings raises a glass to writers and readers, we join in, celebrating the good fortune of finding this lovely book. There are so many songs about books, songs inspired by specific authors and their works, songs that use books as a metaphor for life experience, and songs that show us how many ways books and reading are a part of life. The Talking Heads consider The Book I Read in their own unique way.
I'm writing about the book I read. I
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Aaron Greenwald discusses and signs Marc-Antoine Caillaux and the Company of the Indies in Louisiana, Trade and the French Atlantic World. Tuesday, June 21st at 6 at the Historic New Orleans Collections Williams Research Center, 410 Charters. Adam Crittenden, Stacey Balkin, and Sarah Slaughter read their poetry Thursday, June 23rd at 6 at Maple Street Bookshop. Michael Murphy, author of Eat Dat, Fear Dat, and Hear Dat, discusses food and voodoo and music Thursday, June 23rd at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. Issy Onerick is the guest host for the Bank Street Open Mic, Thursday from 6:30 to 9 at the Bank Street Bar and Grill, 4401 Banks. Patrick Hemstreet signs The God Wave, Sunday, June 26th from 2 to 4 at Garden District Bookshop. Fiction writer and poet Carolyn Levy reads from and signs her new novella, Regina, followed by an open mic Saturday, June 26th at 3 at the Maple Leaf Bar. And Beth Ann Patrick signs The Books That Changed My Life, Tuesday, June 28th at 6 at Octavia Books. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, Our Lady of Holy Cross College, and the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. Or you can email us anytime at thereadinglife@wwno.org. I'm Susan Larson. Thanks for listening and keep reading.